Evangelical Political Conservatism, the ninth talk in a series titled Modern Alternatives to Biblical Christianity, was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 28, 1996, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Let me right up front try to give you my thesis so that you know where I'm going and then see if I can get there. It seems to me, this is not true for all of you, but what I want to argue is that political conservatism is fundamentally inimical to biblical Christianity. They are alien worldviews, alien philosophies, alien theories, radically different perspectives on life. Now, I say surprisingly because there's so much in our current situation where biblical Christianity and political conservatism hold common ground and overlap and share common values and so on. And I guess if there's anything I want to communicate tonight, is that we must not be confused by the common things that political conservatism and biblical Christianity share. We must not allow that to deceive us into thinking that they are compatible, because fundamentally, I will argue, they are not compatible. That's where I'm headed. But to do that, we have to talk about, first of all, I think, what conservatism is, and talk about that at length here for a second. The first thing to recognize about conservatism is, in defining conservatism, is it's not one thing. There are many, many, many different kinds of conservatism, many different theories that go under the label conservatism. In other words, conservatism is a label that we use, that particularly gets used in the media, that gets used in popular culture, and gets attached to a lot of different things that are not at all the same. They're fundamentally different from one another. But because of certain likenesses, popular culture has decided to slap the same label on all of them and say, well, they're conservative. But to call someone conservative in that sense is not really to say too much. It's not really to give you a good glimpse into their worldview and their social theory and their really worked out perspective on life. That you don't know where someone stands if someone calls you a conservative. It just doesn't say enough. So I want to make a distinction between different kinds of so-called conservatism and look at each of them a little bit. But there is one thing that all conservatism has in common, I think, that makes them all conservative. And that is a rejection of liberalism.
Not liberal.
No, I'm not actually. In fact, I have to wonder, I'm not knowledgeable enough to know that this is true, so take this with a grain of salt, but it seems to me probably that the origin of what we now think of as conservatism happened as a reaction to liberalism, namely as a reaction to the French Revolution, I think. People took a look at the French Revolution and said, whoops, this doesn't work, this is not a good thing, and started thinking about social theory in the light of the failure of the French Revolution. I don't know for sure if that's true, but some things that I was reading suggested that maybe that's the roots of it. So if that is right, then from its very inception, conservatism was a reaction to a form of liberalism. What I mean by liberalism, in rejecting liberalism, is the liberal tendency to treat individual desire and impulse as the final authority and arbiter of individual action. That's what I mean by liberalism. And I will argue that next week. The liberal tendency is to treat my own particular individual desires and impulses as somehow the final authority on what I should do, what I should be free to do, what I should be able to do, what I can do. And to reject any and all alleged authority which would inhibit or stand in the way of the pursuit of my individual desires and impulses. Now, that essential kind of liberalism is something that all conservative theories reject. That'll make more sense next week when we talk about liberalism a little bit more. But that's really all they have in common. From there, we have different kinds of conservatism. First thing I think we need to understand about conservatism is that in all these things that I'm going to talk about, all these different kinds, is that we're talking about a theory of social ethics. That's what we're talking about. And there's a lot of different things you could talk about. You could talk about economics, you could talk about salvation, theories of salvation. But when we talk about someone being conservative in a theoretical sense, we're talking about a certain theory of social ethics. That's the arena that we're speaking to. And in that respect, then, we have to, first of all, talk about what I will call traditional conservatives. Traditional conservatives would place traditional culture above individual impulse as the arbiter of social ethics. Okay? Now, so what a traditional conservative says is you have all these liberals out there who just want to do their own thing, and they want society to get out of the way and let them do their own thing. And so their theory of social ethics is legislate, govern, control society in such a way that people can do their own thing. Now, there's more to liberalism than that, but this is what conservatism is reacting to. This is the part of liberalism that all conservatism is reacting to. So what do we do instead? No, people shouldn't be allowed to do their own thing. So social ethics should be governed by what tradition says people ought to be able to do and ought not to do. Traditional culture defines for us what is right, what is wrong, what is appropriate, what is inappropriate, what is acceptable, what is not acceptable. There are several things that, let me talk about several premises of traditional conservatism that lead them to that conclusion. One of their fundamental assumptions is that time-tested human tradition in any given culture is a repository of accumulated wisdom and even truth. I put truth in quotes because they would certainly acknowledge that no culture is infallible. I mean, it'll be a collection of wisdom and some mistakes. But for the most part, the longer that culture exists, the longer that culture thrives, the longer that culture develops, it's going to purge itself of its mistakes and its evils and its anti-social, anti-societal assumptions and institutions. And it's going to be a repository of institutions that are good and right and true. So every culture, every cultural tradition is a repository of accumulated wisdom. Along with that assumption is an assumption that no scientific theory can match the truth and wisdom of tradition. Liberalism, basically and fundamentally, arose during the time of what we call the Enlightenment. That time in the history of Europe where people begin to think that, look, we don't need the church to tell us what to believe. We don't need the church to tell us what to think. Newton has just done phenomenal things by just sitting down and thinking. We can do that. We don't need to believe the church. Let's sit down and think about things. And in thinking about things, we're going to discover what's right and good and true. Human reasoning can get us there. We don't need any authorities to get us there other than the authority of our own human reasoning. That's all we need. And that's sort of the fundamental spirit of the Enlightenment. It was throwing off the shackles, the bonds, the chains of authority. That's one aspect of the Enlightenment. The other aspect of the Enlightenment was, wow, are we becoming smart here? Science, especially. Physical science is really, really making us smart. You know what? Why don't we start applying our knowledge to solving social problems? Let's manage ourselves. Let's organize ourselves according to scientific principles. Let's use our scientific knowledge, even though sociology had not been born early on. It was born during this time. But, you know, sociology, social psychology, political theory, political science. Let's learn from these disciplines. And once we've learned and discovered what's true by these disciplines, then let's centralize some authority and some political power, some societal power, that will then use this knowledge to organize our society and our culture and make it really good. We can make progress here. We can become better than we are. We can become better than we have been. And get rid of things like poverty and, well, get rid of hunger and starvation and poverty and disease and on and on and on. All these social ills that plague us, if we just manage ourselves right with this newfound knowledge, we'll solve things. Well, that's liberalism. That's when liberalism was born. And those are the two aspects of liberalism, is this scientific, theoretical managing of society, as well as shaking off the bonds of authority. Conservatism reacts to that by saying, but you don't understand. What you don't understand is that your scientific theory is ultimately short-sighted. We're not that smart. We're not so smart that we can understand human relationships and human societies well enough to capture it in a single theory. I think probably the paradigm arch enemy for conservatives would be Marxism. Because Marxism is kind of a classical, paradigmatic, liberal theory that says, I now have this theory that tells me how history works. And now that I know how history works, let's organize our societies to make history work to our advantage. And that's what Marxism says. And conservatism looks at that and says, take your silly theory and trash it. I mean, you don't have a clue, Marx. I mean, you're arrogant if you think that you have figured out how history works. How do we know how history works? The way we know how history works is a much more implicit, tacit level of human understanding. And that implicit, tacit, intuitive understanding of what works in human society gets embodied in our traditions, in our traditional institutions. We know how to relate to one another. We know how to function. We know how to build a society, even without knowing how we know how to build a society. You see what I'm saying? It is so complex. It is so multifaceted that we can't pretend to articulate in a theory how society should work. We can only know it at this much more implicit, tacit, intuitive level that makes its way into the institutions that we build for ourselves. Okay? That's traditional conservative assumption. That's why we protect our protectors of our tradition rather than people who throw off our traditions and rebel against our traditions. Because in them we have a repository of real knowledge and real wisdom. Second assumption of traditional conservatism is that there is no transcendent point of view from which to judge or evaluate the values and practices of a particular culture. Whatever changes are going to happen within a culture, and there will be changes, culture is not static, but whatever changes do occur are going to be forced by the happenstances of history, the exigencies of history. And as the circumstances and happenstances of history come along and kind of test our institutions and ultimately shape our institutions, they're going to lead us in the direction of greater wisdom and greater truth. So yeah, we'll make changes, we'll make adjustments, we'll have to flex as different circumstances come along. A culture and a society is going to have to flex, but it's going to basically know what to do. It's going to basically make the right kinds of changes and go in the right direction. We don't need to recreate our society. We just need to let its traditional institutions happen and evolve naturally in time and organically in time. But we cannot stand outside of our culture looking down on it and go, ooh, that's not good, and that's not good, we need to change that. We're inside of our culture, and we have no perspective outside of our culture from which to judge the truth or rightness or wisdom of the things that we do in our culture. History itself is going to have to be our tutor. I cannot be the tutor of my culture, the teacher of my culture. History is going to have to teach us. And therefore, every culture will be a little bit different. You know, it's not like there's just one and only one right way to do society. We Americans may have one right way to do society, and some European country may have another way, and some Asian country may have another way, and they may be very different, but they're all workable, doable, wise, and true ways to run a society. And within the context of that society, people need to honor and respect and trust the traditional institutions of that culture and that society. Third premise of traditional conservatism is a fundamental assumption, I might even call it optimism, that human society must and will progress. It must progress and it will progress. We can count on it. Corollaries to that, there's the fundamental optimism that truth, wisdom, and goodness will and must ultimately triumph in human history. We can relax and know that a society is not workable if it's not somehow in touch with what's wise and true and good. It's going to fall apart. It's going to die and be destroyed before it can embody things that are wrong and unjust and evil and inappropriate. So the fact that a culture is surviving is in and of itself evidence that it is somehow in touch with some kind of wisdom. You see a kind of the evolutionary theory that's behind, the same kind of mentality that's behind evolutionary theory, kind of the survival of the fittest. Although traditional conservatives typically believe in a kind of objective truth, may believe in God and objective reality, so they'd speak in terms of, to the degree that we are in touch with that objective reality, to that degree our society is more and more stable and survivable and workable. Did you have a question?
You're saying that's an assumption of conservatism?
Of what I'm calling traditional conservatism, yeah.
You're not validating
it. No. So far I wouldn't validate any of these assumptions. Yeah, no. That's what I'm saying, is that this is an alien worldview to the biblical worldview. This is a completely and radically different view of life. Another corollary to the progress of human society is the fundamental assumption that people left to themselves are usually fundamentally good. I mean, a prime spokesman for that, I think, is Rush Limbaugh. You know, when you listen to him, he really does not like any kind of negativity in our assessment of the common person's abilities and potential and character and so on. It's the government that messes them up. If you got the government out of the way and just let the people, you know, do their own thing, they'd be fine. They'd be resourceful, they'd solve their own problems, they would have the character to be merciful, to be kind, to be charitable, so on and so forth. Just leave them alone and they'll show you what kind of stuff they're made of. I think he's giving voice to this fundamental assumption of traditional conservatism. Fourth assumption, centralized governmental control can only, in the end, be a hindrance to the good of society. Lord Acton is a famous early conservative who said, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. In the end, if you centralize power in some kind of government institution, it's not going to do you any good. It's only going to bring harm. It's only going to bring destruction. It's not going to bring any good. Again, completely the opposite assumption of liberalism, that would like to centralize power and in someone who has the scientific knowledge about what a society should be so that they can impose that wisdom and knowledge on the entire society. So a centrally controlled corollary, a centrally controlled society can ultimately, no centrally controlled society can ultimately be effective. It will inevitably be destructive.
If I have my notes right, you define liberalism as individual impulse being kind of the ruling idea.
That's one important tenet.
But yeah. Now you're saying that liberals would tend to want a centralized government to dictate how society works.
Yeah.
And I see those as opposite things, so
yeah.
If you can clarify.
What I will ultimately argue is that both conservatism and liberalism are ultimately incoherent. They're filled with contradictions. And I think that is a fundamental contradiction in liberalism, that on the one hand, they individual freedom and liberty is a huge value within liberalism. On the other hand, another aspect of liberalism is we need to have people who have the scientific knowledge and know-how to run a society, to tell us how to run our society and to run our lives. And how you put those together is it's difficult.
Conservatism is the same contradiction, but backwards, is what I'm hearing.
Let's see.
Yeah. Saying that tradition is most important and it's not individual impulse, but then it's saying that the government should stay out of our lives. Because
yes, yeah. But that's not, at that level, it's not quite the same obvious incoherence, because what they are suggesting in place of government is not individual liberty, but the more informal structures of a culture, church, family, various informal structures, that what they're arguing is those have much more effectiveness in shaping the moral character of a people than government could ever hope to have. And we need to get out of the way and let them work, let them do their job. Family is a big deal, for example, within traditional conservative. Okay, that was my next point. In fact, then another fundamental assumption is that informal societal sanctions and structures are more effective promoters of moral behavior than legislation and government sanction and control could ever be. But those are the much more effective governors of moral behavior and character.
Do you agree that this is fundamentally what conservatives in America are arguing? Isn't this like the big fundamental thing, that point
point right there? Yes, yeah, and that's a point that I have no quarrel with. That's a place where, even though I don't think the Bible directly addresses that issue, a combination of biblical worldview and common sense would lead me to agree with conservatism at that point. I think that's right. Makes sense to me.
Read that again, Jeff.
The informal societal sanctions and structures, the informal sanctions and structures in a society, are more effective promoters of moral behavior than legislation and government sanction and control.
What would you define as informal
sanctions? Peer pressure, pressure to conformity within a society, shame, reputation, honor in the eyes of other people, family acceptance and family sanctions. Yeah, the teaching of a church culture, the teaching of your church, the teaching of your religion, yeah.
Uh-huh. When you talk about shame and peer pressure, that seems very relevant to what the end result would be as far as its ramifications on society, meaning peer pressure and shame, I don't know what basis you might have a beneficial effect on society as a whole. If there's really no, if the shame and peer pressure is extra biblical.
Oh, right.
Yeah. There's no gain. I mean, where does that start? I mean, does the shame start when somebody pulls the trigger on somebody else's head or it's shoplifting? I mean, as far as the rules of society and the way society is set up, I think it could work, but I don't know how.
Well, here's what a conservative is saying. Maybe I'm missing your question, but here's what a conservative is saying. If someone is a member of a gang in East LA, and they're faced with a situation to commit some crime, maybe even some really violent crime, in order to save face in his gang, he's got that pressure on him. And he's got the pressure on him of the law, which says you will go to jail if you do this. What wins? He's saying that saving face with the gang is infinitely more important to him than whether he's obeying the law or not. And so the point that they're making is that those real life pressures that are right in your face every day are the much more real shapers of your moral behavior than the legislation. And that just makes sense to me. I mean, and that's why our society is in such sad shape, is that no matter how many laws you pass, you've got all of these subcultures that have abandoned what's good and right and true that are teaching morality to people.
Yeah.
This is no Mayberry RFD.
This is what?
This is no Mayberry RFD.
Right, exactly.
I mean that's the model that most conservatives have in their minds, that if you could just get back on the farm and get back into these small communities where people knew each other's families and the police didn't take your son to jail, he kind of brought him by and he took him out back behind the shed and there was people at your church who, knew, that these kind of social sanctions are what we want to get back to.
Mm-hmm.
Jack, is this, what I'm hearing, are you saying that basically conservatism and liberalism are basically, they join the hips, obviously, by themselves to the hips?
Yeah, that's what I will ultimately argue, is that we really have to understand that traditional conservatism and liberalism were over here. And as over against both of them is biblical Christianity. In very important ways, it's a distinctly different view of reality than either of these.
With that consensus that as far as they're joined at the hips, have you ever read a book by Marilyn Ferguson called The Acorian Conspiracy? Mm-hmm. She's a New Age writer. And one of the things that she argues in there is the fact that conservatives and liberals basically have a lot of the same ideas, and that they need to join together to create this society. And I'm seeing this happening all around me, whether it be in the news, listening to Kuhn's, Republican conservatives and Democratic liberals or conservatives or whatever they might be, that there's this sort of a
Well, try
to force this together.
I don't know. I'd have to look at that. I don't know what to think about. I don't want to. That's not even meaningful. It's great. I don't want to suggest that there's no difference here. I mean, I think they really are fundamentally at odds with each other. It's just that the differences between them are less foundational than the difference that exists between both of those in biblical Christianity.
Well, she isn't saying in that book that they're totally alike. They're just saying that they have enough in common to where they can unite.
Well, I think that's true. I think that's true.
Their society.
What I'm going to say, for example, is that in the final analysis, as much as I enjoy enjoy and appreciate and respect the common sense, the wisdom, the courage, the freshness of a Rush Limbaugh. When all is said and done, if he really, really understood what I as a biblical Christianity was saying, he would reject it. And there's an enmity between his view of reality and mine that is very much like the enmity between their view of reality and mine. And on that, they could agree. That's true. They both don't like Christians. Yeah. Not real biblical Christianity. They both repudiate that. We'll get there, I think. Okay. So what are the alternatives to strict traditional conservatism? Well, on the one hand, traditional conservatism basically is saying we basically need to leave things alone. Let's merely tweak the existing structures as necessary, but let's basically leave things alone. That's where conservatism gets its name. Let's basically leave things alone. Liberalism, in contrast to that, is saying we must remake our society to conform to what reason, science, and progress, what they call enlightenment. I mean, you see where this is coming from historically, that the enmity between liberals and conservatives typically is that conservatives are idiots and liberals are enlightened. Liberals really know what it's really all about. They're no longer subject to prejudice and ignorance and lack of education and so on and so forth. I mean, that's been the public image of liberals as opposed to the public image of conservatives for as long as I can remember. Conservatives have always been represented as kind of backwoods, rednecked idiots, and liberals are educated, you know, enlightened individuals. So out of that enlightenment that liberals have, we must remake our society to conform to what reason, science, and the progress of human knowledge teach us is right and good and appropriate. But we have to remake society. We can't just tweak it here and there. It really needs to be redone right by enlightened people. Another alternative to traditional conservatism would be, I'm going to coin a word here. I think I'm coining it. I don't know. But theocratism, that is the making of a theocracy. That is, we must remake our society not in the light of what my enlightened human reasoning has brought me to, but we need to remake our society to bring it into complete conformity to the revealed will of God. That most Muslim societies are theocratic in that way. And it seems to me to be a growing tendency within evangelical circles today to want to turn America into a theocracy. That is, let's get back to the Bible and let's make laws and create institutions that make our society bring it into complete conformity to the will of God. Let's settle for nothing less than that. That's different from traditional conservatism. It's coming from an entirely different place. Let me stop there, just because I don't know if I'm going to get to it. But on the other hand, do you see the overlap between traditional conservatism and, say, theocratism? The overlap is that as an accident of history, I mean, providential accident of history, as a providential accident of history, most of the traditional structures that conservatives are looking back at and saying, let's leave them alone, were devised by Christians from a Christian point of view, out of a Christian worldview, because they believed in the revealed will of God and wanted to conform society to that. So obviously, there's going to be a lot of agreement and shared values between someone who wants a theocracy based on the revealed will of God and a conservative who simply wants to maintain the traditional structures, precisely because those traditional structures historically were answerable to that revealed will of God in one way or the other. How accurately or not is another question, but at least the Bible influenced what Western civilization became. And that is our culture. Western culture, and traditional conservatives are saying there's a lot of accumulated wisdom in that traditional culture of Western civilization. Let's honor it and respect it. Let's not throw it away. So you can see a tremendous amount of overlap that's going to exist, but for fundamentally, foundationally different reasons. The traditional conservative may not even believe in God. He believes in the wisdom of tradition, not the infallible truth of God. So those are fundamentally, foundationally different theories of how you come to your social ethics.
Then when you take it, or did you already say this just a moment ago, or am I jumping away a little bit ahead? I was going to say, then when you take it just a step further than you just said, and go to that theocracy, theocratical rule, then you're smacking the lap of a liberal with a state-run system of morals or whatever.
Yeah, I mean
of institutions. Yeah. Then your conservative political movement is now completely liberal. You've got a mother government, which is completely non-conservative. That's a very liberal notion.
Yeah.
But it's done on the bureaucratic level, so would the conservative have schizophrenia at that point?
That's just where our labels really don't serve us well. They break down. Because to call, what should you call someone who believes in theocracy? Should you call them a liberal or should you call them a conservative? Well, on the one hand, there's some very, very liberal-like features to their thinking. On the other hand, there's some very conservative-like features to their thinking. I don't know, what should you call them? We arbitrarily assign, the far right, the religious right, as the media likes to call it. Well, why should we call them the right?
That could be.
They're actually very radical. They're actually very leftist, is what they are.
We got in the end of what the right wants. It's almost communal.
Right.
In a way.
Well, and yeah. But even if it weren't,
yeah.
The point being, they're not radically for conserving culture. They're for radically turning it on its ear, is what they're for. They want to completely transform it. Well, that is more meaningfully called radicalism. It's more meaningfully leftist in its leanings rather than rightist in its leanings. So it's very confusing, the labels that we have slapped on things. The right is not very rightist sometimes, and the left is not very leftist sometimes. Sometimes it's very conservative. So I think we're better off just throwing away the popular labels and analyzing the point of view. In the end, we're better off making our own analysis, I think.
Don't they basically, the more entrenched that a nation gets into a certain type of thinking or governmental system, the more it changes, then the opposite view that was against that in the beginning, or was for it, that was very liberal in changing it, it would then become the more conservative view because it would not want to change as time goes on, and then the ones who want to change would then be classified as more liberal, more reactionary wanting to change.
Yeah, potentially. Of course, traditional conservatism is not stuck. I was looking on the internet and there was a little web page on conservatism where he was answering some questions, and one of the questions that got asked him was, since this country is so liberal, isn't it the conservative position to want to stay liberal? And he answered that, I think, quite adequately, is that, to summarize, that's being a little short-sighted, that a conservative is not saying, whatever situation you find yourself in, defend it. that's not what conservatism is saying. It's looking at this, this accumulated wisdom of long-standing traditions in that culture that nurtured us. And the culture that nurtured us is not what the liberals of our day say nurtured us. It's what actually nurtured them. Things like family. How many liberals actually grew up in a traditional family? They may espouse a theory that wants to do away with the traditional family, but shouldn't we look at the fact that they themselves were nurtured by a traditional family and give that a whole lot more weight than their theory about what they think ought to happen? And I think that was a good answer. That's the philosophy of conservatism is not It's not a mindless theory that whatever situation you find yourself in, protect it. That doesn't make any sense. Okay, let me define radicalism, that I think is also a needs to be seen in distinction from traditional conservatism. Radicalism takes the position that what is needed is a transformation of society at its very foundations. The evils of society are rooted so deep in the very foundations of our societal assumptions and values. They're rooted deeply in the assumptions and values of our society. Therefore, what's needed is for us to go right down to the roots, right down to the very, very depths of the foundations of our assumptions and values, and transform those and make society all over again. Liberation theology that we were looking at last week is in that regard a kind of radicalism. It sees the institutions as being fundamentally wrong. And they don't just need to be tweaked, like the conservatives would say, and they don't need to be scientifically managed, like the liberals would say. We need to start over and build brand new institutions and brand new structures based on radically different assumptions and values. That's a radical point of view. And then we can talk about utopianism, which I'm going to distinguish from radicalism. Radicalism assumes that from within a society we can start over and go right to the depths and to the roots and rebuild it. Utopianism, as I'm defining it now, suggests that what is needed is not a transformation of society from within, but a replacing of this society with a wholly different society from without. Let's not just remake this society from within, let's just scrap this one and have someone hand us a new one. Okay.
Hey, Jack, with these definitions, put a little Webster picture.
What's a Webster picture?
Just a little, like, of an example you see. So let's start with radicalism and then go with the utopianism of what you, something recently that would fit that definition that you've seen. Maybe in the media, maybe in history.
Okay, radicalism would be liberation theology, would be Marxism, would be a kind of radicalism. Liberalism would be what predominates in the media and in the academy, the college and university, the media, most of the public sector of American society today is liberalism. We want our government to fix us. We want those enlightened congressmen and presidents and bureaucrats to pass the right laws and make the right policies to fix our society and rid it of poverty and injustice and racism and hatred and malice and hunger and everything else. Theocratism would be Saudi Arabia in Islamic cultures are, from the standpoint of their religion, are theocratic. I think... really? Mormonism is? But I think something like the Christian Coalition, I'm not sure, because I haven't read any of their theory, if they even have theory. I mean, I don't know if there are any theorists among them. They may just be strategists. But if there are any theoreticians in the Christian Coalition, it's very possible that what theory that they would develop would be theocratic in nature. That is, we want to bring this nation back into conformity to the will of God. So we want our laws to reflect what the Bible teaches and da 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 da. And if that's the case, then that's a kind of a theocratism. Theonomy, have you heard of that theology? Rush Dooney and Greg Bonson and... That was a kind of theocratism, that they believed that the Old Testament law should be made the law of this nation, or at least a modernized version of it. Utopianism I don't know if there really is, by my definition, any other form of utopianism other than biblical Christianity. What I'm going to argue is that true biblical Christianity has a social theory that should be described as utopianism. We can't fix what's wrong with us from the inside. We can't remake ourselves. We can't recreate ourselves. The problem is so basic, so foundational, so deep into the root of who we are that only God can create the society that we need. He's going to have to hand it to us from the outside. We can't recreate it from the inside. And I would argue that the biblical Christianity is utopianism. Did I get them all?
What about Dominionism?
I think that's a form of theocratism, yeah.
Well, then wouldn't a lot of the Christian coalitions probably be along those same lines?
I think so. I think so, yeah. I'm not really all that familiar with it. Yeah. Did that help?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Where would white supremacy and, like, David Koresh and these guys?
Yeah, I don't know their social theory. I don't know. I mean, in potentially, it could be anywhere here, just depending on how they put the pieces together. And I don't know enough about what they say to... Denise?
Now, I'm not sure I understand your diagram. You have traditional conservatism in the center, and all these are as if offshoots from it?
No, I'm sorry. That's misleading. The only reason I drew it this way is the way I've organized my ideas is I want to help understand this by its relationship to these. Yeah.
I see.
That's confusing.
And so then, can you again, just as you kind of define each of those, could you again then define traditional conservatism in relationship to each?
It's the view that we basically need to leave our cultural institutions alone. Not that they don't need changing. There are some changes that may be needed. So we may need to adjust our institutions to meet the needs of our place in history and so on. And that's fine. But let's basically respect the institutions that we have and leave them alone, because they didn't come about accidentally. They're there because they work. They're there because they represent the accumulated wisdom of centuries, millennia. So let's leave them alone.
And that would happen in the home, in the schools, in the churches.
Yeah, our educational institutions, our institutions of family and marriage, our institutions of community and local government and all those kinds of things. Leave them alone. Don't mess with them. Don't change them. Don't trash them. Leave them alone.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because I'm so used to conservatism being in... hand in hand with Christianity, that I'm really not aware of conservatives. Are you saying that they really don't embrace an objective view of truth, and they really don't have God as a higher authority?
Right. Traditional conservatism is not fundamentally a theistic worldview.
Really?
Yeah, it's fundamentally... It, too, is a child of the Enlightenment. It's just a more enlightened child of the Enlightenment, I think. But it, too, is a child of the Enlightenment in that it's quite willing to dispense with God and reveal truth. It believes in objective reality, typically. Have you ever read Ayn Rand or know anything about Ayn Rand? She's a libertarian, I believe, isn't she? A libertarian conservative that I haven't even talked about yet. But... she's adamant that there is objective truth, objective reality and objective truth. But she's an atheist. She just thinks that the objective truth there in reality that we need to come to terms with is a rationally ordered cosmos. So
then why does... it just seems to me that our culture links traditional conservatism with Christianity, albeit an empty Christianity. Why is that?
Because historically, the traditions that Western civilization looked to were traditions that were devised by a basically Judeo-Christian culture. So there's going to be a lot of the revealed truth of Scripture embodied in those traditions that they look to as the accumulated wisdom of centuries and millennia. So there's going to be this huge overlap between the institutions that they want to protect and the institutions that Christians respect, precisely because they are answerable to the revealed truth that is our final arbiter of, our final authority and our final arbiter of ethics. So there's going to be a tremendous overlap. And that's what's so confusing. That's why it's so easy to think, I'm a Christian, so therefore I'm a political conservative. Well, by the popular definition of conservative, yeah, I am conservative. But not by the philosophical, theoretical assumptions. According to the theory of conservatism, I'm worlds apart as a biblical Christian. I'm a utopian, not a conservative. This is my term. I don't know what else to call it, but it's the term that I'm using to describe it, to distinguish it from conservatism, is I'm a utopian. I'm looking to the kingdom of God, and I really think the kingdom of God is the only answer to the social ills of our time. And I think it's so far out of reach of a human being that we human beings could never recreate it and fashion it. Because I, the craftsman of that, am going to create the monster. Everything I touch, I'm going to create a monster no matter what I do, because I'm evil. Logan, and then...
So a secular humanist and a deist could sit down at a table and both agree that the human being is the highest level of existence. One may or may not consider it the highest level of creation. The other one could define, secular humanist could define the human as the God that could rule. But that won't necessarily put them in either or any of these camps, right? Because the reality that they have to... the most important concept of reality is going to be the nature of the human heart.
Right.
Now, a Christian's going to believe that the human heart is evil compared to the standard of God's nature. The deist will say that then the where to land as far as what the human heart is, and the secular humanist has no standard at all to right. judge the human heart by. It just is what it is.
Right. Yeah. So you'll find a lot of secular humanists who are traditional conservatives. Yeah. They don't have any problem with that. Because they have to look somewhere to authority, and they look at liberalism that looks to one's own individual self as an arbiter of authority, and they look what they do, and they look what has happened, and they go, whoops, that that ain't working. And they rightly, I think, see that there's a whole lot more promise in the traditions and institutions of Western civilization than in do-it-yourself, do-your-own-thing liberalism. And they're right about that, I think. But that doesn't make them Christian, is my point. It makes them a little bit more awake.
Yeah, you're a better neighbor in this life.
Yeah. But. Bob?
The biblical Christian understands that the utopia that's the only true solution to society's ills is not going to happen in this world.
Right.
Is there, or is there not, in your opinion, a political model or a structure or framework that the biblical Christian should prefer in this lifetime? I mean, knowing that the ultimate solution is not going to happen.
I'm going to go out on a limb. I may one day eat my words here, but I think not. I think the answer to that is no, there isn't.
So part of what I'm asking then is the biblical Christian understands human nature to be a certain kind, and that is basically evil. So then one of the primary functions of government and society would be to arrange the structures of society to minimize the effects of that evil and to somehow create this balance of powers and forces and the ability to express your evil and for the evil to have damage on society, to create the best framework for controlling and for minimizing the damage of our evil while we get along. I mean,
until I was thinking about this lecture tonight, or whatever this is, until I was thinking about this subject for tonight, I would have been inclined to have said a balance of power, maybe a Republican representative form of government, sort of roughly democratic and so on, is certainly a more biblical...
realistic, I guess.
And more realistic. Well, biblical in the sense that it takes into account the reality of human evil and human sin and so on. But the thing that struck me as I was thinking about this is it not true in the final analysis that when all is said and done, the character of the people makes a significantly bigger difference in the quality of in the health of a culture than the form of government? So, for example, we have all kinds of ingenious balance of power in the form of government in this country, but it's not doing us a bit of good these days. Because the judiciary has lost their mind, the legislation looks like they never had it, and the president? I mean, you've got this balance of power, but all three branches of government in this country are so foolish anymore by biblical standards. I mean, they're so darkened in their understanding and so foolish that who's balancing who? I mean, so they're balanced. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And what's happened is a gradual decline, a gradual moral deterioration, a gradual spiritual darkening has come over the entire culture. That regardless of the form of government that you've got, we're in a heap of trouble. And the form of government is not protecting us from that. So what if you have the option of an utterly dark, spiritually darkened, moral, degenerate culture that has a democratic form of government, or another a culture that's not spiritually darkened, that has spiritual sensitivity to what's true and right and good, and is a absolute monarchy where the monarch is a man of character who really... Well, which would you prefer?
Thailand. I'm thinking of the king of Thailand.
These days? Are you serious? I didn't know that.
I've heard you recommend something on the order of a benevolent dictatorship as perhaps being the best human form of government for this age. I don't know if you still think that or if that was...
I actually don't know. My more to the point is... One of my critiques of the reason I have it on the list as an alternative to biblical Christianity is evangelical political conservatism is if I'm going to make the critique of liberation theology that it is worldly, then I dare not make the same critique of what I'm calling evangelical political conservatism. It too is worldly. To the extent that it is preoccupied with fixing our culture rather than believing in and hoping in the kingdom of God that is to come, to that extent, we are overly invested in this world. And I have to make the same critique of political conservatism that I do of liberation theology. It is not really fundamentally what Christianity is all about to hand us a way to fix our life in this world and to fix our culture and to fix our society. It may happen, it may not happen. Can I legitimately and responsibly work toward changes in my culture? Sure, of course, absolutely. But do I place my hope in that? No. If I do, then I have departed from the biblical gospel. See, that's what the fundamentalists really understood earlier in this century. You know, they... they're criticized by evangelicals these days for this position. But the fundamentalist said, our problem is not our society. Our problem is our hearts. And the best thing I can do is to evangelize, spread the gospel, and in hopes that the human heart will be changed. That's the best thing that I can do. So the debate was between evangelism or social action. And they opted clearly and unmistakably for evangelism in that debate. Well, they are roundly criticized by modern neo-evangelicals these days for having made that choice. I mean, what a socially irresponsible, I don't know what all they say, but I just think they were right and modern evangelicals are wrong. I mean, they were making a good choice there. That was a very biblically insightful choice to say, maybe my society, I don't know if they would have said this, but maybe my society will go to hell. You know, maybe my society will completely fall apart. Maybe life will be miserable for me. Maybe I'll starve because of all the problems that get created by sin and corruption and moral degeneration in my society. But what else can I do except proclaim the hope of the gospel? But see, we get so concerned, we get threatened, we get panicked about what about my status and my place and my prosperity and my lifestyle here and now in this world. Isn't it too going to be threatened by the social sea changes that are happening? Well, the reality is, yeah, they are going to be threatened. But what am I more concerned about? Preserving my status and my standard of living here and now in this world, in this life? Or is my life and existence invested in an uncorruptible, undestroyable treasure in the age to come? And to whatever extent I have shifted my hope off of the treasure that is stored up in heaven and onto treasures that I have here right in front of me stored up here on earth, to whatever extent I've done that, the Bible presents that as a fatal, fatal spiritual mistake. And to that extent, I am being unbiblical, anti-gospel, anti-Christian. Worldly, yeah. Casey, did you have a... Okay. Gordon, and then Alice.
This isn't going to be very popular, what I was going to say. At least among a lot of Christians. I think since I moved up here from L.A. and I'm a few years ago, both my wife and I have been very adamantly against abortion and the homosexual rights thing. And we've known a lot of people that have been against it and active politically against it. But more and more since I moved up here over the last few years, and especially over the last couple of years, I've come to the conclusion more and more that the abortion issue, and I think now the homosexual issue since the Supreme Court ruled a couple of weeks ago, on what they did has basically become a dead issue. And I actually saw this before that, and the reason for that is because if you pass by 51% anti-abortion legislation, what good is it going to do you if in the schools, in the hearts of your kids, when they come up, they're being taught all this humanism and all this garbage? When they come right back up again, they're going to end up pushing abortion right back up into the limelight. And so I've come to the conclusion, basically, that like just what you said, that it's a change of heart that's going to have to take place. Maybe our society is going to end up being another Roman Empire. It's going to fall. Maybe we are in the last days, and the tribulation is coming, or whatever is going to happen, however that fits into history. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that we are in the middle of a very quick downfall, very, very quickly. And the church, if it keeps going the way it's going, trying to fight these political battles, is going to find itself really on the short end of the stick.
Okay, let me comment to that, though. I don't think the implication of what I'm saying here is not that, therefore, we who are biblical Christians should just sort of sit back and let it all happen and not raise our voice against it. On the contrary, I think it's very appropriate that we raise our voice against it and put up a stink about the direction our culture is going. Why? Because we want to fix society? No. But for the sake of my own soul, for the sake of my own integrity, for the sake of my own wholeness, for the sake of my own discernment, that I call evil, evil, and I call good, good, and I don't allow the distinction to be blurred. I need to keep my own moral discernment sharp and active and engaged. And that's going to lead me to both speak and maybe even act. But it's different to speak and act for the sake of your own integrity. That's different from speaking and acting because I want to fix my society.
That's exactly what I meant.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
Because I think that the church and Christians now have a false hope.
Yeah.
Because they're putting themselves in.
I mean, you really see that because they, you know, their mood and their morale shifts with whether they think they're winning or losing in this culture war. The reason the culture war, I think, is very real. And those articles that say it's not, I just astound me. I mean, what world do they live in? The culture war is very, very real. We have a collision of two absolutely, completely incompatible moral paradigms in our culture today. And there's no compromising between them. They're absolutely irreconcilable. And that's a war. And the one of them is going to win. You know, is going to win the hearts and minds of our culture and going to be established and embodied in the institutions of our culture. And it can't be both of them. It's going to have to be one or the other. So we definitely have a war and a power struggle going on. We need to fight in that war, but we don't need to fight because it's somehow incumbent upon us to hand God a victory. We need to fight, as I say, just for my own integrity's sake. In the end, it really ought not to matter to us whether we win or not. That's up to God. That's taken care of by God's providence. It may be the appropriate thing to happen to this nation to be judged by God for its unbelief, to be judged by God for its hostility and rebellion against Him, and the judgment will come in the form of getting what we want. I mean, that may very well happen. And I need to be able to welcome that. I mean, read the prophets. I don't know if it's Isaiah or Jeremiah, but one of the prophets talks about what a good thing it is that God is bringing judgment on His people. And he's looking forward to the day when this judgment will come. Well, why? I mean, it means economic disaster. It means material disaster. It means nothing but destruction. But morally, it's right and good and appropriate. And I would say this country has a lot to answer for. America has a lot to answer for. And if we answer for it in terms of a judgment of a complete collapse and deterioration, then in the end, I have to say, thank you, God, for bringing justice to bear on our situation. Now, that's hard to say, because we could get hurt. You know? But in the end, I think we need to be willing and able to say that. Logan?
It's a misconception to think of the gospel as the escape clause for our world. I mean, some people can become so divorced from their social environment in their hopes for the sweet by and by, that they're not actually believing in the gospel for their the redemption of their soul, the rebuilding of their character. They're believing in the gospel for the escape from this. Like, I'm going to die, and then I'm going to go to a really neat city where the streets...
So I don't want to think about now.
And I don't get mugged. And what should be paramount on their mind is that the Christian who is bought by God is redeemed after death to be a holy person. It's not... I escaped this terrible environment for a good environment. If that's what you're looking for, that's not what the gospel is all about. The gospel is about you going from being a bad person to being a good person in this redemptive process. And I think that sometimes when people, like I say, detach themselves from their quote-unquote social responsibilities, claiming that it's because of their devotion to the gospel and the kingdom to come, they're not. I don't hear them talking about their redemption from their sin. I hear them talking about the gospel as an escape hatch. Well, it's all going to be over soon and we'll be in a nice place. That's not what Jesus was talking about. Jesus was talking about you're not going to be a scumbag forever. you're going to be a beautiful person. That's what this is about. That's what will create the kingdom of God. Another thing that strikes me is that in our time, in our place, because of the political structures we have been given a voice, and we've been given a vote, and we've been given a hand. That is, in fact, a responsibility incumbent upon us now that we can't abandon.
Yeah.
If God has said, look, for what it's worth, you get a vote. You get a say. This is not a monarchy. Just or unjust, your leaders do not have total say. I'm putting that in your lap. Well, I feel certain, if I'm going to have a voice now, these institutions are formed, then I think that I have a responsibility to God to try to move them towards being formed upon the moral realities he's revealed to us.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I agree with that.
I could sit back in my own moral integrity and just not participate in my culture. Unfortunately, I'm put in a culture where I've been given the opportunity to participate
right.
in the culture.
And it's not much integrity if you just shine on that responsibility and you go, yeah,
no.
I agree. Yeah.
People could take a piece of this and just run with it, and they're not talking about the gospel. They're not talking about a moral accountability and responsibility.
Yeah. Well, I'm running out of time here. I wanted to make sure I got to my critique. Maybe some of it is self-evident, but can I just quickly go through some of the... Let me jump down here to the differences between biblical Christianity. Biblical Christianity would not respect tradition as either traditional conservatism or even a religious conservatism. Notice that not traditional conservatism, but what I call religious conservatism, something like Bill Buckley. There's a lot of compatibility with religious conservatism and Catholicism, Roman Catholicism. The reason being, both of them respect tradition. Roman Catholicism, because they respect the accumulated wisdom as to how to interpret the revealed will of God, and traditional conservatism believes in a accumulated wisdom about how to run society. Well, religious conservatism is different from traditional conservatism in that it doesn't trust tradition as such. Rather, it wants to form society theocratically according to the... Well, I shouldn't... Just cancel that. Forget that. It's not theocracy. It wants to make law conform, I like the way you put it, to the revealed moral realities. But what are those revealed moral realities? Well, we look to tradition to see how to rightly understand and interpret that revealed truth. So, in both cases, they respect, for their own reasons, they respect tradition. It seems to me that biblical Christianity is no respecter of traditions, because biblical Christianity is so convinced of the darkness and foolishness and evil of the human heart that it understands that the values, the accumulated wisdom of traditional human cultures is going to fall short of the wisdom of God. It's going to be the wisdom of this world, not the wisdom of God. Look at the first three chapters of 1 Corinthians, where he contrasts the wisdom of the world with the wisdom of God. Yeah, there is a kind of wisdom in this world that we learn how to get what we human beings want. But the problem is, what we human beings want is ultimately not good enough, because we don't want the age to come. We don't want the kingdom of God. We don't want the values that God has purposed for us to be fulfilled by. We want worldly stuff. And the wisdom of this world is ultimately going to be fundamentally worldly and therefore inadequate from a biblical point of view. So tradition will be inadequate. It will not be an adequate wisdom that it is the accumulator of. A biblical Christian would not share the optimism of traditional conservatism. And it seems to me there's also kind of a corresponding optimism in a Bill Buckley kind of conservatism as well. I don't think biblical Christianity is ultimately optimistic. As a biblical Christian, it seems to me, I know that there are no guarantees. In fact, if I read Revelation, I think it's going to be a disaster at the end. if I read Revelation rightly, and who knows, who knows if you're ever reading Revelation rightly, but it sure looks to me like it's going to end in a bummer. And if it were not, for Jesus intervening at the very end, the bad guy was going to win. There wasn't any kind of inevitability of the triumph of good over evil in history. In fact, evil could have easily won were it not for that unknown factor of God, who kind of stepped in and messed things up. And then finally, I don't think biblical Christianity would see widespread popular involvement in government. I didn't get to the point of making this, but traditional conservatism sees a devolving of power as being a safeguard against evil, because power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Therefore, don't centralize power, devolve power down to local level and into as many hands as possible, the whole balance of power idea, and that will be a safeguard against evil. I think biblical Christianity doesn't put that kind of faith in the widespread popular involvement in government. Because as I say, I mean, we live in Eugene, for goodness sakes. We of all people should know that you can have a whole culture, you can have a whole society that is blind and doesn't see straight at all and is perfectly capable of any kind of evil. Nazi Germany was not just merely the imposition by some dictator of his own theories. It had to be
swallowed.
It had to be swallowed by a whole culture. And I think we can see there's a lot that Eugene could swallow in the end that I wouldn't like, that I wouldn't agree with. So the biblical worldview is not primarily, I would argue, is not primarily nor fundamentally conservative. Rather, it is primarily and fundamentally radical and utopian. Biblical Christians who uphold biblical Christian values will be labeled conservative by our culture only as an accident of history, not because of any commonality in their basic outlook on life and social theory. As biblical Christians, we are radical. We believe the problem goes right to the roots and the foundations of our society, and we believe that it's not fixable from within. We're looking to someone to fix it from without. So we're radical and utopian, which is to say, we're not conservative. I better call it a night. As I suspected, I have not... Oh, just one last comment. This struck me. One of the things you run into in the prophets is that Isaiah or Jeremiah, when they're predicting the downfall of Jerusalem and Israel and so on, will say, many will come prophesying in my name, saying, peace, peace. But there will be no peace. I don't know if that's a direct quote, but that's a sentiment, and you run into that a number of times. And I remember that oftentimes when I'm listening to Rush Limbaugh, because Rush Limbaugh is someone who's saying peace, peace. He's a prophet to our nation that's prophesying peace. Look, you guys, it'll be okay. We just need to. And there's a kind of fundamental optimism there. And we have to remember that optimism is often the message of a false prophet. If God wants judgment, there will be judgment. There will not be peace. And it is not our place to stand in the way of God's judgment when God has decided to bring it. It is our place to accept it and understand it and embrace it, not to reject it. Let's call it a night.